singer-songwriter and guitarist Anna Calvi returns with her new album, Hunter. Featuring the single Don't Beat the Girl Out of My Boy, Hunter is a queer and feminist record that explores sexuality and breaks the laws of gender conformity. The album has a primal energy in which Calvi pushes the limits of her guitar and voice beyond anything she's recorded before. Hunter, the new album from Anna Calvi, is out now on Domino. Proud sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
And welcome to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3, Sydney's local and independent current affairs. I'm Stephanie Chu. Today on the show...
These are towns that have gone without a dentist for several years. Perhaps may have never had a dentist in town.
How long have you put off going to the dentist? Oral health is one of the greatest areas of health inequity in New South Wales, according to the Council of Social Services of New South Wales. Also coming up on Razor's Edge.
Quite a lot of them can fit inside a matchbox. So if you're holding it in your hand, it is about, a lot of them are about the same weight as a pen.
Miniature microbats are living all across Sydney, and they're under threat. Tomorrow is National Threatened Species Day. We look at the Sydney locals needing our help. All that and more coming up on Razor's Edge. But first... The Uniting Medically Supervised Injecting Centre in King's Cross is the first in the Southern Hemisphere and the English-speaking world. On top of their normal work supervising the safe injection of drugs, the centre runs programs to foster social inclusion for drug users in the community. One such program is their annual art exhibition running all of September, which features work from the centre's clients and aims to validate their own experiences. There are currently 10,000 children and 100,000 adults waiting to receive public dental care in New South Wales. We talked to a Sydney dentist who has taken a mobile dental unit to treat remote communities.
For 8 years, the Uniting Medically Supervised Injecting Centre has been running their Art from the Heart exhibition. The exhibition, which showcases and sells work produced by the centre's clients, is in its biggest year yet.
So many of our clients wouldn't have or don't have that safe and supportive space to express themselves.
Matt Dibiyawan is the Acting Health Education Team Manager at the centre and has been closely involved with running the exhibition.
A lot of the people that visit our service are sleeping rough, they're homeless, and they've had many, many years of that life. And so you can imagine how difficult it would be to produce art, to keep your art supplies nice and neat and tidy, and if you're sleeping rough and having to move from place to place.
Since all of the work is available for auction, does that become an added value as well for the artists?
Certainly, the putting a dollar value to it does touch someone's self-esteem and sense of self-worth. One artist that I spoke with last year, she's quite prolific this year as well, but last year, something in her just clicked where she realized that people wanted to buy her artwork, and that gave her such a sense of fulfillment in terms of other people connecting with her artwork and wanting to own something that she has expressed on the canvas.
Do you think this exhibition has played or will play a part in debunking the myths around this group and bridging social inclusion for them?
Something like this approaches the myths from hopefully getting people to have a bit more empathy and compassion for everyone. And the reason I say that is because I think that each of us, we're all human beings, and we all have some inherent and innate creativity inside of us. And hopefully it can help people realize, you know, we don't need to be judgmental or even hateful towards people who are viewed as criminal in terms of drug use.
Will Tregoning is the co-founder and executive director of Unharm, a grassroots organisation advocating for safe, positive and ethical drug use. Living in King's Cross, he's noticed drug users are socially marginalised as quote-unquote junkies. He believes the exhibition could help to humanise and include those in the community.
I think what this kind of exhibition calls us to is a recognition that people are people, regardless of what drugs they may use or the life experiences they might have had. And to be able to see the creative potential of people who are clients of the Injecting Centre is a really powerful way of reconnecting with the broader community, you know, which both is a challenge to the idea that people who inject drugs are, you know, to be pathologized and treated as suspect or as, like, inherently medically or socially problematic, but also shows that there is this beating heart at the center of the Injecting Centre, that it isn't just about a place to take drugs, but it's actually a place where people take care of one another.
Why is this humanistic element so important?
Well, the whole idea of prohibition was about creating barriers in society and pushing people who use particular substances out to the fringes. It was always about power and about depersonalizing people who were seen to represent something socially deviant. If, you know, if we keep holding on to that sense that some people are just not fully people and should be pushed out of society, we can never really achieve well-being together. That's not a way for a society to flourish. And so these kinds of exhibitions call us back to that sense of, you know, shared humanity.
I asked Matt why he enjoys his work so much.
Helping people do artwork in an injecting centre is just mind-blowing, actually. Talking with people about a really beautiful part of themselves that maybe has been or they've neglected for a long time. One particular artist this year said that he's had emotions inside of him for more than 40 years, and painting this year helped him release those or confront those emotions that he's been avoiding for so many decades. That just fills me with unspeakable joy and happiness.
Matt Dibiyawan, the Acting Health Education Team Manager at the Uniting Medically Supervised Injecting Centre in King's Cross, ending that report from Tara Wesson. The Art from the Heart exhibition is on display this September from 11 a.m. Monday to Saturday at Sydney's Art House Hotel. All the works are on sale in a silent auction and can be bid on and viewed at www.uniting.org/art from the heart. You're listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. I'm Stephanie Chu. There are currently 10,000 children and 100,000 adults waiting to receive public dental care in New South Wales. We talked to a Sydney dentist who has taken a mobile dental unit to treat remote communities.
Have you ever decided to hold off on dental treatment because of the cost?
Well, in rural New South Wales, and even in some urban Sydney communities, people are waiting sometimes years for basic dental care.
So in terms of numbers, we know that there are about 10,000 children and 100,000 adults on public dental waiting lists in New South Wales, and sometimes they can wait, you know, months for treatment, and their problems might be getting worse over that time.
This is Dr. Kathleen Matthews, Vice President of the Australian Dental Association in New South Wales.
In New South Wales hospitals, there's approximately 18,000 hospitalisations for dental conditions, and that they're potentially preventable hospitalisations. And we know that that's a huge cost to our health system. We also know that there are links between having poor oral health and other chronic health diseases like diabetes, like heart disease. We know that there are strong links there, and then we know that perhaps by improving the oral health of people with those conditions, that might also improve the chronic diseases from which they suffer.
Why is providing good quality, efficient, effective dental care a problem for New South Wales? Why does that seem to be such a challenge?
That's a really difficult question to answer. Why is it so hard? It's a great question. I think that so some of it's about infrastructures and resources, and some of it's about the model of care. You know, what's the best way to deliver dental services and the most economic for communities as well?
Is it a priority?
I think that there's a lot of demands on our health budget, and I think that government works in partnership with the private sector as well as the public dental sector to try and deliver an effective service. However, sometimes the demand sort of outstrips the supply.
A Sydney dentist, Dr. Jalal Khan, has decided to do something about the problem. He's taken a mobile dental unit out to southern Queensland and northern New South Wales communities.
It's quite big, actually. I wouldn't call it a van. I'd probably call it a truck. It used to be a horse's float, actually. It used to transport horses around. And the front part of the section is the cabin, which has got 5 seats for a driver and any other passengers. Middle section, which is kind of like an accommodation area, a nice waiting area, a little kitchen there as well. And then towards the back of the truck is where the actual dental clinic is housed. And in that, we've got a modern dental chair as well as digital X-ray equipment, air conditioning, and all the other necessary equipment that's required to run a dental practice.
Dr. Khan services up to 15 to 20 patients a day. He says there's a critical need for dental care in rural areas.
These are towns that have gone without a dentist for several years, perhaps may have never had a dentist in town. And so I'm looking to provide some comprehensive dental services to the locals. Because of a lack of funding or inadequate funding, so there's a huge waiting list for just the basic things like dentures or cleans, and the patients are going without teeth for years because of this wait list, which is really sad to see.
Neil Campbell lives in Bourke. He was treated in Dr. Khan's mobile dental unit just this week.
Yes, I had two teeth taken out this morning and had two fillings.
In the past, he's had to travel over 3 hours to access basic dental care.
Last year, I needed some dental work. I was in Bourke, and the nearest dentist was in Cobar, 160 k's away.
For Neil, being able to access dental care easily makes an enormous difference.
The benefits are that he's virtually right at my front door.
Clearly, Dr. Khan's mobile dental unit is filling a gap. But what about the dynamic between the public sector and private health providers like Dr. Khan, who are taking the initiative to service communities that aren't being reached by the public health system?
Yeah, I feel that the public sector is quite territorial in their health service delivery. They don't want to outsource it, particularly in dentistry. And the reason for that is partially to do with funding, but perhaps also the public services have got to achieve a certain number of dentures or a certain number of crowns or a certain number of dental services over a period of time in order to secure funding for the next financial year. And if they don't reach that, or if they're not achieving that, then that funding gets reduced.
I think that when private sector and public sector can work in partnership and there's consultation between both sides, I think that's a really good thing. I suppose a van is a different way of doing it, and I think that it's important that if that is the way that things are delivered, that it's kind of done in consultation with the community and takes into account the needs of all the community.
Here's Neil Campbell in Bourke.
I'm looking at dentures long term, and so we'll do some more preparation work for those, and then he'll be back in town in November, and he should be able to provide the dentures for me then.
So you'll have a whole new set of teeth before the end of the year, is that right?
Yeah, I'm certainly hoping so, yes.
Dr. Jamal Khan is currently in talks with homeless hostels to use his mobile dental unit to provide regular services to the homeless in Sydney. We'll bring you a follow-up on that later in the year. You're listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. I'm Stephanie Chu.
Spring is here. Swap out those winter greys as Sydney Fringe is in full bloom. This year, we're filling Sydney with more shows than ever, enlivening our new Oxford Street and Darlinghurst hub. Immerse yourself in 30 days of theatre, comedy, circus, live music, dance, food and lots more. Celebrate the best independent live performances this city has to offer. Book your tickets at sydneyfringe.com today. 2SER is a media partner of Sydney Fringe Festival.
The connection between social media and religious extremism has emerged as a prominent issue over the past 10 years. The recent trial of two 16-year-old boys charged with terror offences and the arrest of a local university student last week has drawn attention towards the issue of online radicalisation. Ellie Campbell spoke to Hussein Nadim, director of the South Asia Study Group at the University of Sydney, on how young people are vulnerable to being radicalised online and how recent government policy has proven to be ineffective.
This week, a Sydney teenager pled guilty to terror offences after being radicalised online at the age of 12. Over the past 10 years, social media has emerged as a central tool in the recruitment of children into extremist agendas. Hussein Nadim, director of the South Asia Study Group at the University of Sydney, says one of the driving factors influencing these cases lie in the influence of foreign events communicated through the media.
Now, a lot of it is driven partly because of the ongoing world events. You have Lebanese young Muslims sitting in Australia looking at their TV and seeing what's going on, for instance, in Syria or in the Middle East where the U.S. is dropping bombs. So a lot of these kids get politically radicalized. And then you have, coupled with that, the online extremist propaganda. A lot of times these Islamic jihadi groups are not conducting their recruitment through normal procedures like mosques, for instance, or sermons, but they're using online tools like short video clips, Facebook posts, Twitter messages to reach out to these kids and kind of like ask them to feel the plight of what's going on in the Middle East.
According to Mr. Nadim, young Muslims living in the West are far more likely to be recruited into extremist viewpoints on the internet if they are isolated from their society.
The families that are well integrated within the Western societies, Australian or British, their children are more actively involved in the society and the nation and etc. in the workforce. The children's family that are not well integrated, that do not speak the English language, that are cut off from the larger society, their children tend to grow up with this identity crisis and they are far more prone to ending up on extremist forums where they can be radicalized. So that's one big issue.
According to data from the University of Western Sydney, Muslims living in Sydney are three times more likely to endure discrimination than their peers. Mr. Nadim says the Australian government must allow an open dialogue with Muslim communities in order to prevent further social isolation.
The political level, at the Prime Minister level or the Minister's level, they need to reach out to the community because the community right now feels that it is not part of the Australian society, that they do not have the same opportunity, that because of their Muslim-sounding names, their CVs are not taken that seriously. These are the type of problems that these young kids have. I mean, a lot of them would tell you this thing, that because our names are Muslim, we have Muslim-sounding names, our CVs don't go through the second round. And we have a lot more trouble finding a job. So these are the questions that need to be addressed so to have a sort of connection built with the community.
The federal government has allocated around $47 million towards de-radicalisation programs, including programs in Australian schools and youth detention centres. Mr. Nadim says these initiatives do not assist in countering the issue of de-radicalisation and that the problem lies in the government lacking an informed understanding of the issue at hand.
To be very blunt about this thing, Australian government has no interest on de-radicalization, part of which is probably because they don't think that this is a radicalization problem. If you're talking de-radicalization, a helpline, or investing into millions of dollars of de-radicalization at school program, de-radicalizing 6 to 15-year-old kids, that's not the policy. That is a discriminatory policy that they have pursued. So I think the Australian government lacks understanding exactly what is driving this.
In August, Senator Fraser Anning gave a speech to Parliament calling for a ban of Muslim immigration to Australia. Mr. Nadim says these attitudes are not only counterproductive to the issue of radicalisation, but are further fueling the agenda of extremists online.
But what statements like these actually help in is essentially the terrorist propaganda. I mean, you have terrorists who can now take these video clips of a senator or a certain parliamentarian talking about banning Muslims from entering to Australia and use that to tell the Australian kids that, look, this is your worth. This is your standing in your society. This is the injustice that is going on and you need to fight this injustice. So they get a sort of narrative that this is not terrorism. This is actually a freedom fight. This is a struggle against a state that is discriminatory. You see, what I'm trying to basically say is that these irresponsible and religiously bigoted statements that come out from the politicians, They only help the terrorist propaganda.
Hussein Nadim, director of the South Asia Study Group at the University of Sydney, ending that report by Ellie Campbell. I'm Stephanie Chu, and you're listening to Razor's Edge. National Threatened Species Day is tomorrow, and while that might make you think of animals in distant forests, some of these species live in our own backyards. Fruit bats are a common sight in the night sky in Sydney, but you might not have noticed their far smaller relatives, microbats. The population of some microbat species is falling, and it has to do with how humans are shaping the environment. Caitlin McHugh interviewed a microbat specialist.
How tiny is the tiniest microbat that we have in Sydney?
So quite a lot of them can fit inside a matchbox. So if you're holding it in your hand, it is about, a lot of them are about the same weight as a pen.
How long is their average lifespan?
I don't think we know exactly, because they're quite hard to study in the wild, but I know in Australia there has been some long-term studies and they are finding them sort of 20 years later, which is quite amazing for such a small animal. Typically, small animals have much shorter lifespans than that. So, a 20 or 30-year-old bat who's the size of a matchbox is quite phenomenal.
That's Dr. Cara Trelfall from the University of Melbourne. Dr. Trelfall wrote her PhD on microbats in Sydney, and now she helps councils to protect these tiny creatures. I asked what she'd found out about microbats in our city.
In Sydney, we actually have lots of species of bats, but we don't know a great deal about them. So in Sydney, we have about 18 different species. And so for my PhD, I was looking at where it is that they like to hang out in Sydney, where they forage, where they eat food, and what sorts of trees they like to roost in. And we found that actually they're distributed all throughout the city and in all of the different suburbs that I went and looked at. I was recording bats in people's backyards really frequently.
And when you say all over Sydney, how widespread is that?
Like quite literally every single place I have looked for bats, I have found them. I've never not found a bat anywhere. All through the CBD, they fly sort of all around the Domain and through Centennial Park and all of the parklands in the city. They've even recently found quite a few colonies of them roosting in and around the Harbour Bridge even.
How do they survive in such built-up areas?
They eat insects, so I guess if you've ever looked at a street light or a light on a sports field, you'll notice that there are lots of insects swarm around those sorts of lights. And so bats eat insects, moths and beetles mainly. So it seems that they're surviving in places like Sydney because there's still quite a lot of food around for them. There's still quite a lot of nocturnal insects that they can eat.
What would you say has been the main impact on these bats and their decline in cities?
I think it's the loss of tree hollows. So they need really, really old trees with dead and decaying limbs. And so they're the kinds of trees that we deem hazardous and we cut them down. We've removed them from the landscape. They're really, really rare. And so when they do exist, they're occupied by all of the kinds of animals that need them. Because in Australia, lots and lots of our fauna really rely on those large old trees with tree hollows, so all of the possums and lots of different kinds of birds and parrots. So when there is an old tree like that, it's a big animal hotel and it's absolutely full, and so there's just not enough room for all the fauna, and bats are quite little and they just get pushed out.
So you said that you worked with some councils to help preserve these bat populations. What did that involve?
So the main thing that we're working with councils on is trying to help them map where they do have old trees in their landscape and work out different ways we can manage the landscape and I guess manage green spaces and public parks and things like that to try and reduce the risk to people from having old trees around and change our management practices so that we can try and keep some of those trees in the landscape.
Which councils were those actually?
Most councils in the whole metro area actually are involved in, to some extent, doing some kind of habitat preservation for bats and for lots of other taxa. So it's almost all of them.
Oh, okay. Great.
Yeah.
Do they face any other threats beyond the habitat loss?
Yeah, if you imagine being an animal in and amongst humans, it's quite a hard life, really. There's a lot of other things other than habitat loss. We also have a lot of issues with invasive predators, like rats and domestic cats even, because bats are quite small and they kind of really smell. They give themselves away as to where they're roosting at night or where they're asleep, so they're pretty easy prey for a cat who's roaming the neighbourhood to go and climb up the tree and get them out. They also are really sensitive to night light, we've found, so even though some of them like eating all of the insects around streetlights, that's only a portion of the bats that we have here. Quite a lot of them really don't like light. And if you think about it, in the city, there's not very many dark places around anymore.
And is there anything that people can kind of individually do to help these bats?
I guess remembering that light can be bad for nocturnal animals is a really important thing. You don't always want to have your outside light on. Having lots of native understory plantings and native vegetation in your garden is really, really good for our insects. And so if you have native vegetation, you'll be attracting a lot of insects to your garden, which then will provide foraging habitat for bats. And then also if you do have old large trees in your backyard, think twice before trying to remove them. There are new ways of trying to protect the tree such that it doesn't fall down. And so I guess that's one of the main things people can do is keep their old trees. We really need to keep them.
Cara Threlfall speaking with Caitlin McHugh. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Razor's Edge is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. If you like the show, catch us again next week on Thursday nights from 7:30. I'm Stephanie Chu. Catch you guys later.
We nearly drowned for such a silly thing. Someone who loves me now better than you. And that pretty friend is finally yours, and I'll be around on Sunday. If you'll meet me at Blue Diner, I'll take coffee and talk about nothing. Baby, at Blue Diner, I'll take anything you wanna give me, baby. Like we promised, have you every time I drive through the city where you're from? I squeeze a little, meet me at Blue Diner, I'll take coffee and talk about nothing, babe. The time.